I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, the enjoyment and preservation of the great outdoors has long been dominated by white people. Is it time to connect the dots to its complicated legacy with race?
When Audubon came to the U.S., he didn't come with empty pockets and pulled himself up by his bootstraps. Man, the guy had gold coins in his pockets, right? Come on, yeah? And one of his first tasks was to go buy some slaves.
And later, as world leaders gather and debate the global climate crisis, how has the environmental movement evolved over the last 30 years?
People of color, indigenous peoples from both the U.S. and around the world started to assert themselves and to contribute to the conversation by demonstrating and identifying what pieces of environment were being left out.
The great outdoors, the environmental movement, and the complicated legacy of race. That's all coming up on Life Examined. The great outdoors has long provided adventure and discovery, peace and wonderment. And the recent pandemic ignited an explosion in outdoor enthusiasts, from bikers to hikers, most of us seeking an escape from our own four walls. Access to nature is free and open to all of us, right? Or is it? For years, outdoor spaces, the wilderness and conservation, have remained predominantly white spaces. And some of the most influential environmental voices, like John Muir or Henry David Thoreau, were white men. African Americans have traditionally been underrepresented when it comes to outdoor recreation and an interest in nature. The legacy of slavery remains complicated. Jim Crow and racial violence have shaped our understanding of who should have access to the great outdoors. Even the simple act of bird watching in an urban park is met with suspicion. Growing up in the English countryside, Jacqueline Scott never had the slightest interest in outdoor recreation. But after moving to Canada, something just clicked. Jacqueline Scott is a PhD student in social justice education at the University of Toronto, Canada. She's a hike leader, writes the Black Outdoors blog, and is an avid bird watcher. Jacqueline Scott, it's a pleasure to have you on Life Examined. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Talk to me a bit about how you fell in love with the outdoors and with nature. Can you give us a little background on this love of yours?
Oh, yes. When I first came to Canada and I was coming from England, and Toronto was a world-class city only in its imagination. And so living in the suburbs, it was some adjustment. But anyway, one day I came downtown and hanging out at my favorite arts community center, and there was a sign there for a canoe trip. I had never done canoeing in my life. I had no interest in outdoor recreation, but because the trip was easy, as in all you had to bring was your own clothes, and they would pick you up and drop you at the same spot, I thought, well, I'm bored, let's give it a try. And on the trip, something just clicked in my soul. I felt so alive, something about being in the wilderness, the trees, the canoeing. And I thought, oh my goodness, why didn't I know this exists? And that was the hook. And then from that, virtually every weekend, I'm out doing something in nature.
And that question there, why didn't I know that this existed or that this exists? That's kind of an interesting question to pose. And I know one that you probably spent quite a bit of time thinking about.
Well, I grew up in England, not in London, in small town, rural Essex. But as a kid, my interest was simply books, 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 and more books. So wasn't interested. But coming to Canada, one, you have the sense here of the great outdoors, and that the wilderness is very different from the wilderness in England. Here, it's like, you know that song about if you go into the woods today, the teddy bear is having a picnic?
So
in the English imagination, the woods is where teddy bears hang out with their tablecloth and eating honey. Well, in Canada, the bears are real. And sure, they do not have picnics in the woods. And so for me, it was this interesting contradiction between my idea of the woods with the bears and the reality, as in you do not want to get anywhere close to those creatures.
Right.
So that was one issue. And then within the Canadian context as well, or maybe even the North American context, when you see outdoor recreation, when you see all the magazine covers, the people that you see doing outdoor recreation are not people who typically look like me, i.e. what you see is a whole ton of white people. I read a lot. And so when you see the books on outdoor recreation or adventure travel, it's usually the story of some white guy and later on white women trekking through the wilderness, having all these adventures. But you didn't see people who look like me. You didn't see black people doing it. And so it really sent the message that when it comes to outdoor recreation or adventure travel, it's a thing that white people do, not black people.
And how did that make you feel initially then, taking a canoe trip or putting yourself out there, knowing that it sounds like this really felt like a white space to you?
I enjoyed it because I've always somewhat marched to my own drummer, but at midlife, I went back to school and I wanted to figure out, well, is it that you're always marching to your own drummer, or is there actually something that's happening in the outdoor space where it's not welcoming for black people? And so through studies, you realize that, oh, black people have a complicated relationship to nature and to outdoor recreation. And a huge part of that is that when outdoors is coded as a white space, it's things that white people do. And so when a black person shows up, it's like, oh, surprise, what are you doing here?
Right.
Are you lost? And so the lack of representation is a major, major issue. Because if you don't see someone like yourself trying something, then even if you're curious, you're probably less likely to try it.
Sure. And my mind goes to how it was white male writers that have dominated the space about writing about the outdoors. In the U.S., I think of Thoreau, I think of Whitman, and so on, that this is a place that there have not even been the black voices historically to represent that experience.
Yes, and one of my favorite books on Walden Pond.
Sure, yeah.
I've read the book. He's a brilliant writer. And what surprised me, though, was him talking about his black neighbors in Walden. Because typically, when you talk around the campfire about the great outdoors writers, Thoreau being one of them, it's like slavery. And it's like, yep, black neighbors, enslaved, and he's writing about the black people in the woods. And then, what's the other guy's name? John Muir.
Sure. Yeah.
Again, another brilliant writer, and he hiked part of the Bruce Trail in Canada. And so, of course, I'm reading his book, 10,000 Mile Walk to the Gulf, I think. And he is walking through the U.S. in the aftermath of the Civil War. So, of course, he's talking about the people that he meets on the way include the black people, the formerly enslaved. But again, in your campfire talks, when you talk about Muir, Thoreau as the founders of the conservation movement, of the national park system, somehow their relationship to black people, all of that gets erased. And so it kind of sends the message that, oh, the classical writers on being in the woods, they had nothing to say about race, when in fact they had quite a lot to say about race.
Yeah. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how what the outdoors and the wilderness symbolized to black people for hundreds of years, certainly in Canada or the U.S. I mean, my sense is it was a very different relationship than a privileged white person.
Very much so. And Carolyn Finney, in her book, Black Faces, White Spaces, does an excellent job in terms of deconstructing that. And so, for instance, you talk about that in slavery days, black people were in the woods, but you were enslaved. Or sorry, you were in the countryside, but you're enslaved. If you went into the woods, it's the memories of the bloodhounds that were bred to hunt runaway slaves. The film Harriet does a really good job of capturing her trying to escape with the bloodhounds on her heels. So being in the woods, you're looking over your shoulder. It's fear. And so the idea, oh, let me relax in the woods. Well, historically, that's the very last place you want to be. In the city, among other black people, you were safe. But if you're in the countryside, if you're in the woods, there is somebody coming after you.
Yeah. And while we no longer have enslaved people, let's say, in the United States, my sense is the stories and the trauma of that, though, it has trickled all the way into the current generations. I mean, those memories are still so present.
Oh, obviously. And Not just in the US, though. Carolyn Finney, one of the terms she used in her book is about the cognitive map of the outdoors. Mm. And so the memories from the US, those also trigger throughout the Black diaspora. So whether I'm in Canada or in England or in the US, that sense of, oh, the woods are not a safe place. And it's like, if something happens to you in the city, the chances are there are witnesses around you.
Yeah.
Right? But if you're in the woods, where's your witness?
Yeah, of course. There is no witness at that point.
Exactly. And so, but if you go into the woods as a group, you can look out for each other. But to go in the woods by yourself or just as a couple, you're not going to do it because the historical trauma becomes a kind of a racial right. haunting in the woods. That somewhere in the back of your mind, there is a seed of doubt, of fear. And even if you can't name it, it is very, very strong. And it basically says, in the woods and you're Black, not a good combination.
One recent example we saw of this, which is how these are still such white spaces, is that of Christian Cooper, a bird watcher. Can you tell us what happened to Christian and why this is such an important story?
Yes, Christian Cooper. So he's into bird watching. And I also love bird watching. And there's a brilliant writer, Dr. Drew Lanham, and he talks about, he's also an expert bird watcher and an academic into birding. But he talks about how it's maybe every decade or so he would run into another Black birder. And when I first read that, I thought, nah, he's wrong. And then when I reflected on my own experience, I realized he was actually spot on. And he wrote 9 rules for Black birders. And one of his rules was don't wear a hoodie ever. And that was, of course, in reference to Trayvon Martin. So fast forward now, here we are. And Christian Cooper, expert bird watcher, a Black man bird watching in New York Central Park. And he met a white woman in the woods and he asked her to obey the posted signs, put the dog on the leash, because dogs running around really disturb ground nesting birds. And her response was to call the police saying that a Black man is threatening her life. Now, that was filmed, it was put on social media, and it went viral. So here we are in nature, in a space that is supposedly anybody can go bird watching. It's free, it's open. But as a Black person, the threat of violence follows you even into that space. One of the outcomes of the Christian Cooper incident, and this happened, by the way, round about the same time as the murder of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. So heightened awareness of Black vulnerability, whether you're in the woods or no matter where you are. But anyway, after it went viral on social media, one of the outcomes of it was Black Birders Week. So organized through social media, Black birders finding each other, supporting Christian Cooper. And it has become a movement on its own.
And you love bird watching. This is a part of your life. What is it about? You know, I'm fascinated by bird watching. I got to say, I don't quite get it. So tell me why you love it and maybe how I can learn to love it.
My kid will come with me on whether it's skiing or snowshoeing or hiking. But she refuses to come with me bird watching.
I get it. Yeah, sure.
There is something. Yeah, she says, no, it's just too geeky. You have binoculars. With bird watching, it's a chance to slow down and really observe the nature around you. And these days, I'm much more aware of the climate crisis because the birding migration patterns are off. But you notice nature. You see how humans are part of nature, how much we need nature, and also how much our impacts affects nature. And with bird watching, there is something to me that is spiritual about watching birds fly. Because if you're feeling miserable, depressed, or the PhD is turning out to be so much hard work, and you just need a break, go for a walk, go watch the birds, and suddenly your problems go into perspective. And it's just beautiful sense of, wow, this is life. birds can fly, my spirits can fly with them.
And I sense there's something about this almost mysterious world 20 feet above our heads that we know so little about, and that you, with this knowledge, are able to tap into this kind of beautiful orchestra above us. Is that true too?
Oh, very much so. I don't do church, but outdoors is my church because it is where I feel alive. It is where I feel part of nature. For those who are religious, it's where I feel closest to God, because you feel the life around you. You feel the sense of this thing is so beautiful, so precious. And for me, not only do I want to create access to it for Black people, but I also want to protect it. Because it was outdoors that led me to being a land steward. So I spend a lot of time in the ravines, which are kind of mini forests in Toronto, or long river valleys. And you become part of the crew who's trying to plant more native plants so that the birds have better diets. And then you become aware that, oh, if you do nothing, the ravines could easily have houses built on them. And so for me, it's bird watching in the outdoors is what led me into conservation and the awareness of how precious life is and how quickly it can go away.
And there are, you know, some other changes we're seeing around us right now. For example, the U.S. conservation group, the Audubon Naturalist Society, has announced it will change its name. This is due to pain caused by the 19th century ornithologist and slaveholder John James Audubon. And it almost reminds us of what we were talking about with some other of these well-known writers like Muir, which is that, you know, we have these kind of sainthood-like white figures that dominate these big Audubon societies or others. And only now are we really beginning to realize that the story was a lot worse than we thought.
Yes, a lot more complicated. Audubon, his books are absolutely magnificent. The Birds of America. And he did come to Canada in 1833 to paint birds here. And it's the same year, by the way, that slavery was abolished in the British Empire, including Canada. Yes, there was slavery in Canada for 200 years. But anyway, I've read Audubon, again, a brilliant writer as well as a painter. And the way that we think of Audubon, he is the founder of ornithology and conservation, but Audubon was born in Haiti. He was the heir to a sugar plantation, and sugar plantation in Haiti, well, guess who was doing the work on the plantation? The enslaved people. And when Audubon came to the US, he didn't come with empty pockets and pulled himself up by his bootstraps. Man, the guy had gold coins in his pockets, right? Come on, yeah. And one of his first tasks was to go buy some slaves. And so again, the link to slavery as the source, one of the main sources of his wealth. And it's about how slavery allowed him the time to paint the magnificent birds of America. And so it doesn't take away from the brilliant conservation work that he has done, but it does become a reckoning in terms of how race and conservation intersect. And so, yes, this group has changed the name, but what I'm more interested in is, okay, so how many Black people are you going to hire? How many are you going to promote? How many are you going to support? And because of all the conservation sites, where is the recognition that all those sites are on Indigenous land? And therefore, where is your outreach to Indigenous people in terms of hiring, promoting, and supporting them in terms of conservation? Name change, yeah, it's in the news, but again, for change, it's in a step. I'm much more interested in the jobs, in the hiring, promoting, and supporting Black and Indigenous people in those jobs than the name change itself.
I think this is such a big question, and you're talking about a really important tension here, which is, okay, what do we do with the really mixed legacy of an Audubon or a John Muir or these characters? Do we throw the texts out entirely? Do we just think about them in new ways? What do you think?
Absolutely do not throw them out.
Okay.
that does not help anybody. It is much more looking at the complicated legacies and to honor the work, but look at how race shapes that work and continue to shape it. So yes, you can keep Audubon's name in places if you want. I really don't care. What I'm interested in is, again, Where are the Black and Indigenous people in your organizations? What do they have to say? What are the different ways that you can honor the contribution of those groups in the conservation fields? If you can do that, then it's like, okay, keep the name Audubon or whatever, but it's about the change. And I think too often, especially because this is the George Floyd effect, where organizations are looking for the quick fix, they want to look good. But change, that's not real change, that's tokenism. You know, having one Black person on the board is not going to change anything. Having another magazine spread with a couple of Black people on it, yeah, it looks good. But if the organization is not hiring Black and Indigenous staff, then it's just mere tokenism. And it's like, oh, are you waiting that, oh, once this goes away, we'll go back to business as usual?
Right. I've enjoyed so much just getting your thoughts, hearing your stories. What, talk to me about something in the outdoors you're still looking forward to doing or some of the spaces you're still interested in exploring. I'd love to end with that.
I like adventure even in my grand middle age. And so I am hoping that I can still do the Black Canada hike.
Oh, what's the Black Canada hike?
Yeah, that was planned and then COVID came and then COVID came again.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. There's a massive hiking trail that runs across Canada called the Great Trail or the Trans-Canada Trail. So it's the equivalent, I guess, of you guys' Appalachian Trail or Pacific Crest Trail. And what I would like to do is to hike the Trans-Canada Trail, the Great Trail, but at the points where it intersects with Black history. And so, for example, if you're up in the Klondike, you're talking about the Black miners who were part of the Klondike Gold Rush. Because the assumption often is that in Canada, Black history started with the Underground Railway, the Underground Railroad, and Harriet Tubman bringing ex-slaves from the U.S. to freedom in Canada. But there's 200 years of Black history here prior to that, based on slavery. And often when we think about Black history in Canada, it's seen in terms of recent immigrants. So in a nutshell, what I want the hike to do is to have the grand adventure, like the best of the outdoor riders like Muir and Thoreau, but doing it by highlighting the Black history in places on the trail. So if you're in the prairies, you know, the cowboys, the Calgary Stampede, the biggest cowboy celebration in Canada, probably in North America. Well, what about the Black cowboys like John Weir? It was they who started the stampede. That's part of their legacy. But when you think of cowboys like Black cowboys, it's like, yep, we were here, hundreds of us. So it's having the grand adventure and at the same time celebrating Black history here. So that to me is something that I'm hoping I can pull off a part of it for next year.
That sounds awesome. But, that sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. And of course, finishing school.
Yes, indeed. Well, I hope you do both brilliantly. And I've been speaking with Jacqueline Scott, PhD student in social justice education at the University of Toronto. I really enjoyed chatting with you today. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a lovely conversation.
Still to come on Life Examines, the evolution of the environmental movement. How Indigenous peoples, youth, and minorities are shaping the conversation. Dorcita Taylor from Yale joins us and shares her remarkable story of growing up in the poor Jamaican countryside to becoming a leading voice in the world of environmental scholarship. And if we have any new listeners, we hope you'll take the time to subscribe to our feed and leave a comment wherever you listen. It's a small way to help us grow the show and only takes a moment. We'll be back after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. As we just heard, having access and being able to appreciate the great outdoors benefits all of us and society, especially when it comes to conservation and preservation. So as world leaders gather and debate the global climate crisis in Scotland, do minority groups get a seat at the table? And are their voices being heard? Does everyone have equal access to clean air and water? In her book, The Rise of the American Conservation Movement, Power, Privilege, and Environmental Protection, Professor of Environmental Justice at Yale University, Dorceta Taylor, talks about America's long white history with conservation, environmental justice, and just how much race and inclusivity have impacted the climate movement in the aftermath of George Floyd's killing. Dorceta Taylor, it's a pleasure to have you on Life Examines. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Dorceta, I'm very, very curious about where you're from and this road to becoming a professor at Yale. Where did you grow up? Well, what was the early part of your life like?
I started life on, I was actually born on a slave plantation, as I've discovered recently in doing family genealogical history in rural Jamaica. And I stayed in the rural parts for the first 11 years of my life. And that was in the 1950s to 60s. So life was not charming for young girls in rural areas. But I had a teacher who one day walked into the classroom and says, "We are going to learn a new topic. It's called environmental studies." And she wrote out the actual words on the chalkboard. And then, you know, she, after we wrote it down properly in our books, she then lined us up and marched us out of the classroom down to the banks of the river. Our school sat very close to a river, and we just kind of sat on the stones there and did environmental studies. And I literally was hooked from that point. The second point of hook that led me to Yale was shortly after I learned to read and write, because again, rural kids weren't always sent to school. So at age six, I was just learning to, I was just teaching myself to read and write, not learning, teaching, because I had been dropped off in school and realized that everybody else knew what their full names were. I didn't, and could read and write and spell it and knew the alphabet. So I put myself in a boot camp and literally taught myself to read and write so I could function in this classroom and not incur the wrath of the teacher every day. And she had wrath. But as I was doing this, I quickly went through the books in the children's part of the library. And so I just started to go into the parts of the library and picking out the biggest book I could find. So I didn't have to go every day to beg the librarian to have me take out another book. And in that book I was reading, and I came across the word Yale University. And it was just one line after that that said, "It's a great university." Not knowing A, what a university was, B, that Yale did not admit women at the time of my little ambition, C, they certainly were not admitting Black students. I decided that I was going to go there one day. And, you know, just continued doing a lot of biology, zoology, botany, chemistry, that sort of stuff, because I was in the science track. So when I came to the US, I continued along that track because I really, really liked, that was my sweet spot. I just really always engaged in the environmental things, liked the outdoors. And so when I finished undergraduate or was finishing up, when I was looking for graduate school, guess which one was at the top of my list to look for?
Right.
And I had to go down to the library and pull out, I think, is it Peterson? To even find, you know, does what I want to do fit into Yale's plan for what I want to do? But I ended up there and did my master's and my doctorate and went off to teach elsewhere, and 35 years later returned last year to be a professor.
Well, you've become an expert among many topics, but looking at the history of environmental movements, and particularly, you know, what's on a lot of our minds right now is what's happening in Glasgow. But thinking about when this type of a movement began, and tying into what you're saying a little bit, my sense is going back to what we think of as this early environmental movement was primarily a lot of white people at the head of this. Is that true as well?
Yes, it still is in a way. But another very critical event for me was Earth Day 70. And I distinctly remember us going to school that morning, and there were these speakers. I think some of them were white Americans, some were like from Britain. Their color wasn't what caught my attention. It was this notion of an Earth Day and how we were going to really be treating the Earth differently. And if they used the words conservation and preservation, I didn't hear it. What I was thinking of was what an interesting kind of idea. And this is something I wanted. This just fascinated me. But yes, you were right. If we look at the American environmental movement, any of the countries in Europe, if we look at Canada, these were at the time predominantly white, upper middle class movements, bar none. Their conceptualization of environment and even Earth Day was one that portrayed whites as actors and doers and people who engaged in environment. What was missing was a discourse that connected environment to social inequalities or explored environment as it was lived by people who were poor, both in the US and abroad. And so environmentalism became something that in the US, people of color would derisively describe it as a quote unquote white thing, because they didn't see within that conversation the issues that were going on in their communities. And if you look back to 1970 or before, communities of color had excessive toxics in it. They had run down dilapidated homes. They had poor transportation. They had polluted waters. So both urban, because if you look, if you go back into like 1970, you see where urban environments are downplayed completely in this discourse. Almost a discourse about wilderness, trees, birds, faraway places that connected to the original environmental discourses of the 19th century. And what was being left out was urban dynamics, the dynamics and the lives of people of color, both domestic and abroad. If we fast forward to Earth Day 1990, we see something quite interesting happening. And even to the COPs that were going on in the early 2000s, late 1990s, early 2000s, was that people of color, indigenous peoples from both the US and around the world started to assert themselves and to contribute to the conversation by demonstrating and identifying what pieces of environment were being left out. So if you look at even when Al Gore and his team were very involved, they were calling it climate change.
Right.
People of color were the ones that had to indicate to them, point out to them that there's a disproportionality that they're missing because they're not looking at the racial pieces of it. They're not looking at concepts like vulnerability of place. Who happens to live heavily in some of these spaces that you're going to see sea level rise? You're going to see incredibly hot temperatures. They were simply making the argument at the level of climate is changing. It is going to be really bad for humanity. But they didn't stop to ask the question, will it affect all of humanity equal? Or even if it doesn't, who will have the ability to escape, certain dynamics, certain events, and who won't be able to escape.
Right.
And so that's what people of color, low-income communities, you know, after the rise of the environmental justice movement in early 1990, you see that coalescing around the idea of climate justice and people of color interjecting that thought into it, so that by the time we get to COP26, those pieces are now on the table, but they weren't in the 1970s or 80s or at the beginning of the climate conversation. It, you know, it was as if everyone will get equal harm and there won't be any disadvantages and we all need to do something about it.
Right.
But to get to we all need to do something about it, you needed to include those voices that were disproportionately impacted.
It's interesting, as you're talking, I kept thinking of, yeah, there were even earlier moments or flickers of what we think of as environmentalism. I think, for example, of Teddy Roosevelt or the creation of the national parks. We sometimes call it America's greatest idea. But the intention, just as you say, was not on urban areas. It was on this idea of a majestic wildland or these beautiful far-off places that were, frankly, not heavily populated, although there certainly were indigenous populations there that were removed. We have to remember that too. But it's interesting that what we thought of as environment or environmentalism really was quite different from what you're talking about.
So some of the things that I talked about in the book, The Environment and American Cities, was the idea of wilderness being, or environment being framed as the space where American elites wanted to get away from. They thought it was crowded, it was dirty, it was noisy, there was crime, there was racial mixing in these cities that made them quite uncomfortable. So many of them went off to explore the mountains, they went off hunting, they went far away from the cities. And we see conservation and environmentalism being framed as the antithesis to urban areas. And so it's not then very surprising that that 19th century holdover of environment being everything but urban, everything but what has to do with poor people. It took a very long time for environmentalists to understand that it isn't an either or. To be very effective in the environmental things that they wanted to do, they had to engage urban. They had to engage poverty, poor people, racial mixing, and all of those things. And it really wasn't till the emergence of the environmental justice movement in the early 1990s that those issues really rose to the fore, and environmentalists started tentatively to deal with them. But we're now about 30 years into that conversation, and there's definitely more recognition that that these things are connected. And that environmentalism, environmentalists, the movement is stronger if it tries to tackle both pieces rather than trying to segment them and keeping them separate.
I know you've talked about a famous conference in Brazil being perhaps a turning point with this, where suddenly there were indigenous cultures coming out to talk about this, more activists. Is that right?
Yes. So the COP that occurred in Brazil was one of the earlier COPs where large numbers of people of color showed up to Brazil. They showed up to Rio, so the Rio Earth Summit. And it's not coincidental that that Rio Earth Summit occurred a few years after the first People of Color Environmental Justice Conference that occurred in 1990. There was another one in 1991. And you start to see the coalescing of domestic American people of color joining forces with indigenous communities, not just in the US, but in Canada and globally, especially in the global South. And those communities went to the Rio Earth Summit, because Rio Earth Summit was really billed as kind of, you know, the modern iteration of these COPs. And at that Earth Summit, many of the people who were talking along these lines about justice, equity, they certainly were not let into the main parts. They had to almost organize an alternative summit. Many of them were arrested by the police. But since Rio, this idea of indigenous people, people of color, students of color, you know, now go to these things, has become a part of the milieu of what the COP is. You know, so you have the presidents, the prime ministers, they're all in their cloistered spaces. You have the big green groups, you have, you know, some corporations there, but you also have the grassroots. So not just the elite environmental policymakers, but the grassroots people who are also putting their agenda out there at these things.
I'm curious to get your thoughts on this argument. I've heard some people make it, and I wonder if you think there's any truth to it. This idea that for those that are in very impoverished situations where the struggles to simply put food on the table, that thinking about global issues like climate change or even anything like that are just not present, not valid for the way that many live. Is that just totally wrong, do you think? What are your thoughts?
It is totally wrong. When you hear that argument, look at who's saying it. It is going to be a middle-class white person who probably has never had a conversation with a really poor person of color, or who really don't understand how poor people think. And they don't understand, for instance, that, you know, some of the innovations around recycling and reusing materials, those things are things that poor people have to practice on a daily basis to survive and to make their ecosystems sustainable. They understand how to do those things. You know, Native American tribes understood how to manage and use the land in ways that are far more sophisticated than some of the people who are ascribing ignorance to them. So this idea, so if someone is without a home and doesn't have food, those basic things that you need, not desire, not want, but need to survive, are absolutely tantamount and foremost in your mind. It doesn't mean that you never understand or you never think about other aspects of why would we want to think that just because somebody's poor, they don't want to breathe clean and fresh air. Or just because somebody's poor, they're so stupid, they're incapable of thinking that clean water, they'd rather drink clean water than dirty water. So when somebody makes that argument, that's really what they're saying. You know, it's that, so those folks are so incapacitated, they can't appreciate that breath of fresh air that you just pull into your lungs. And you just breathe it all the time. And trust me, as someone who was a poor girl, I can't do big, dirty cities, big, noisy cities. I can't do it because I grew up just always wanting that clean air, that water that is so clean. When the rain falls, it and it's coming pure from the sky. That's what I prefer. That's what I want. I want silence. I'm somebody who I prefer to listen to the birds than people clattering and talking and making noise and buses honking. And so the idea that if you're poor, you have no capacity to think about those things also is often mouthed by people who have no idea what it is to miss a meal, you know, except when they're on a diet. But they have no idea what it is to be poor, or they haven't spent time in poor areas to see the elegance with which people can manage scarcity, but also think about these other things. I mean, I remember throwing a little bit of a hissy fit when I looked at a down pillow case or a down pillow, I think it was at Macy's or somewhere like that, and it was costing, you know, around $200. And one of the tasks I had as a girl in the village in Jamaica was every chicken you killed, the little girls had to pluck by hand the down feathers. And what did we make with it? Down feather pillows. I didn't sleep on a sponge pillow till some person showed up in our village to tell us we were ignorant, barefoot, and backwards, and we should get into the modern century and start using synthetic pillows. Everybody I grew up with, all of us, we only made down. So, you know, and we were doing it because we were utilizing every part of the animal that we killed. We were recycling. We understood that you could get a very good pillow out of down. If you picked the coconut, you didn't just drink the water and throw the rest of it away. There are various things you could do with it. And that's, you know, if we were white and middle class and living in a commune somewhere, we would be seen as living the highest level of living. But because we weren't, we, you know, this notion of you're backwards, you're just worried about what's going to be your next meal. That's not how people think or work. Those people want clean water, fresh air. They want their kids to go to school. They want to see flowers. They want to hear the animals out in the countryside, just like everybody else who can pay to consume it.
Very well said. I'm wondering just about how the language of the environmental movement has evolved to feel more inclusive or to bring along these ideas of equity. I mean, do you feel like it's gotten less jargony and more, approachable for people to think about it more broadly, more personally? What do you think?
I think it's getting there. It's a journey. And I do see, if I look back at the language that kind of jolted me back in 1980, Black people are not interested in the environment. There are a few people who still have those ideas. We're definitely seeing more organizations even expand beyond what we've been talking about, but even reach in and try to understand, for instance, like police violence. You know, we're going to look back at the moment that white cop in Minneapolis put his knee on George Floyd's neck and sat there with it for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. He knew he was being filmed, but he casually had his hands in his pocket while he did this. And this became, I think, in my mind and many other people's mind, a wake-up moment for the environmental movement to ask themselves the question, is this who we are? Is this who I am as a person? What would I do if I were standing there on the street? Would I just continue to look at my bird count or look at my treescapes? Or would I do something? Would I film and put this out, that this policeman be brought to justice? Is this equal treatment of another human being? And I think for a lot of, especially a lot of whites who had trouble understanding how police behavior is tied to race and space, it brought it home for them that, oh, this is what people have been talking about. There's a legacy to George Floyd. His misfortune has become probably one of the biggest collective learning pieces that we've gotten out of this country in a long time.
And Dorcita, I'm curious as to why you would call that horrific incident a wake-up call for environmentalists, versus just a social movement? Where do we see these syncing up, or is there a broadening of the way that you're using the environmental word? I'm curious.
So it helped to spawn a social movement that already begun, and it helped to give life, name, and a face to it, but from the environmental perspective. And it really surprised me how many environmental organizations really kind of started to pay attention to race, racism, and environment after that incident. The younger people that are coming into environmental programs, they're still extremely committed to the traditional thoughts and way of looking at things, but they bring these new ideas to the table of looking at policing and that, or another really hot topic now is the conditions of jails. And what's going on with incarcerated populations, especially when folks realize that they were using prisoners to fight forest fires, but these men were not trained to fight the forest fires, and some were being killed, if the fires are out of control. So here we have climate change. Here we have forest fires burning out of control, and you're using an incarcerated population to do that. So this is where then for those students and young people in environmental organizations, they saw like the George Floyd, the Ahmaud Arbery cases, Breonna Taylor, all of those cases as being environment, as your living, breathing space. And the things that are happening in those space are connected.
I've been speaking with Dorcetta Taylor, professor of environmental justice at Yale University. Thank you so much for sharing your ideas and thoughts with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody. I'm your host, Jonathan Bastian, and that's all the time we got for this week. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you soon.